probably in the future, we'll probably end up with an AI that is like your AI that can, that knows all about you. The AI models, they're trained on the internet. They know everything. They knew all of the books. They passed all the tests, and they just, they're very capable, but they know very little about any individual person, right? It's not a lot, like it's a challenge of today is to get it to understand your data, like what you are and what you experience.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. Welcome back to AI and the Future of Work. Thanks again for making this one of the most downloaded podcasts about the future of work. If you enjoy what we do, please tell a friend, and we'll keep sharing great conversations like the one we have for today. I'm your host, Dan Turchin, CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. We learn weekly from AI thought leaders on this show. And of course, the added bonus is you get one AI fun fact. Today's fun fact: Melissa Hekala writes in the MIT Technology Review that making a single image with generative AI from services like DALL-E 3 or Midjourney consumes as much energy as charging your phone. We've talked about the energy footprint of AI on a macro level, but this article quantifies it in more accessible terms. Melissa cites research from Hugging Face and Carnegie Mellon that found generating text from text is significantly less energy intensive than creating images from text. While training models is energy intensive, most of the energy they consume is used when the models actually generate content at runtime. The methodology seems sound. Energy measures were taken across 10 common AI tasks and 88 different models with 1,000 unique prompts. Sasha Lucioni from Hugging Face developed a tool called Code Carbon to run the experiments. Among other findings, Lucioni found generating 1,000 images with Stable Diffusion XL generates about as much CO2 as driving a gas-powered car 4.1 miles. Given that increasingly AI models perform tasks billions of times a day, the impact of CO2 emissions and consequently on atmospheric pollution that leads to climate change is a real cause for concern. Consider that when deciding how to use AI and specifically image generation, both at home and at work. As always, we'll link to the full article in today's show notes. Now shifting to this week's conversation. Ben Kuss is the Chief Technology Officer at Box and is responsible for developing Box's technology vision and strategy. Previously, Ben was the VP of Product Management at Box before joining Box. He was the co-founder and CTO of Subspace, an enterprise security solution that was acquired by Box. Ben has held various leadership positions, including chief architect for IBM and senior director of technology for Big Fix. Ben studied computer science at the University of California at Berkeley. And without further ado, it's my pleasure to welcome you to AI and the Future of Work. Ben, let's get started by having you share maybe a bit more about your background and how you got into this space.
Sure. I like your fun fact, by the way. It's actually really interesting to think that like when you're using AI, like when it's actually like typing something out to you, it's like one of the most expensive things that you can do for technology at that moment for some of the reasons that you mentioned. So thank you for covering my background well. I think in general, when people ask me to describe myself, I often will talk about, I feel like I'm a computer scientist at heart and a technology nerd overall. And my passion really is just to build sort of technology platforms that can be used by many things and then find really useful applications for them, in particular around the enterprise space. And I've been fortunate in my career to have the ability to both work at different size companies, but also ability to see some of these trends go through cloud, mobile, they've all see how they develop across the industry. And in terms of how I got into this space, the generative AI space, so at Box, we've been looking at this for a very long time, just the state of the art of machine learning, of AI, and then now generative AI. And for the main reason of, you know, we're at Box, we're the content cloud, is what we call ourselves. And so we store and we try to be make useful a lot of files, a lot of content, a lot of images, audio, video, notes, documents, these things that people use within their enterprise. And historically, this has always just been something that's really hard to do, to really fully understand. Usually it requires a person to sit down and try to understand it. And so machine learning can help you, but historically it always helped you with the idea of, you know, you get a model whose job in life was to actually like structure that data. So there's always like when we talk about data in an enterprise, we talk about structured data versus unstructured data. And so our whole life is unstructured, which until recently, it was like just hard to operate on. So as the generative AI space became production ready, became available, became more mature, it was like a dream come true for us. So we are spending like a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of time with our customers to really embrace this fully so that we can get all the best for it for your enterprise content.
Box is notorious for having a very unique culture. You've been at some iconic places with iconic cultures. Maybe if you could give us a sense of how would you describe the innovation culture at Box versus, say, an IBM or even a Big Fix?
Yeah. So yeah, I feel like I do have these fortunate to have this unique experiences because I've, you know, there's a very different world from when you're in a startup that you founded versus like a very small company versus a, you know, very large company like IBM. And then Box, of course, is in the middle of a few thousand people. And so for me, there's interestingly, like some people like will say, what's the innovation like overall? And there's definitely founder-led companies are just often very different. And of course, at Box, Aaron still there, still very involved in a lot of the, especially the new and innovative projects. For a while, it was funny. We would talk about who was the best in the company at prompt engineering. And like Aaron's name often came up in this as the generative AI capabilities became more and more widespread. But so for me, though, like the idea of, you know, the innovator's dilemma of where like sometimes companies are there, they struggle to disrupt themselves. And you start to see that as companies get bigger and more successful. That to me is very true from my experiences. Although interestingly, on the topic of AI, I'm not sure if that still is, if the innovator's dilemma is actually quite in play because, you know, compared to these other big shifts of the past, you might, you know, oh, this new operating system or this new approach, you know, mobile devices, they start to disrupt some other major market. And, you know, cloud disrupts, you know, like the on-prem aspect of the world. But with AI, in a weird way, especially generative AI, it's almost, what's it disrupting? And there's like a, it's disrupting in some ways old AI. And so a lot of companies, I don't think, are actually worried about that innovator's dilemma in this case. So as of like right now, I think you're seeing an awful lot of great innovation from like smaller companies, in addition to great innovation from like more established companies. You know, the Box are spending all our time on it, but then you also see, you know, name a company who doesn't have this like an interesting AI strategy at scale. And so, to me, it's very interesting in this question of innovations is that this time it looks actually weirdly different than some of the other big trends that we've seen in the past.
So let's pull on that thread. So you and I have experienced the shifts that we both discussed, and we've experienced other times when in Silicon Valley, at least, we hyperventilate over some, you know, new technology, and oftentimes we're right, but sometimes we're wrong. Yeah. This time to me feels different versus, say, you know, mobile or cloud or SaaS. What do you think about that shift? Is there something different this time around?
I think in some ways there's a few sort of key differences. So first of all, so I think as you started to say, like one of the famous things is to make sure that you don't try to predict too much for when you're in the middle of the hype curve, right? Like in almost all cases, like people will think that things will happen fast. They think that things will happen at a certain rate. And then in many cases, of course, there's some disappointment. And I think there's definitely going to be some of that, especially with so many big promises being made across the industry. So, but even having said that, I do believe that the technology that enables generative AI is a true innovation, and it will actually become something that you would actually consider to be a platform shift. And to me, the definition of that would be that it has a pervasive, a long-lasting impact, almost to the point where it's like not even remarkable. And I think that like many of the fundamentals of the technology will be in use across the board in the future, the same way mobile, right? Like nobody's like talks about being a mobile company these days or like a cloud company. It's just part of everything that everybody does. And I believe that in the future, generative AI will be described that way too, as something that we all are experiencing in our daily lives in addition to our enterprise lives.
One litmus test I use is that I don't remember ever using the term existential when we talked about, you know, mobile or cloud, right? They were just, you know, new innovative patterns, but yeah, they didn't pose an existential risk. And I feel, you know, AI is forcing us all to, you know, hold up a mirror to ourselves and have this, you know, interesting dialogue about what does it mean to be human. I think at least that's how I think about, you know, why this shift is a little bit more foundational.
I agree. And then I also think you saw a lot of these things coming before, like you started to see, you know, it's not, let's say for cloud, you know, for a long time, people would have their own data centers and they'd outsource other data centers. You're like, oh, I get the kind of, I see how this is evolving. Similarly for mobile, you know, like I have a long history of mobile devices before I got my first iPhone. So you saw that. But with the generative AI, like it, for most people, it appeared one day and then you used it and you're like, this is shockingly crazy. And I think that sort of rapid shift is one of the reasons why you get that existential question. Is like, this changed, and it changed faster than most technology enhancements that are technology shifts that we've seen in the past. And I think even, you know, it's been a year and 8 days since the big ChatGPT release. And so it's like that kind of thing is just new. People are still digesting, I think.
In Gartner terms, I feel like we've perhaps reached the hype peak in terms of generative AI, which would mean that we're due for the trough of disillusionment. You know, you're sitting at the nexus of enterprise adoption of generative AI. How controversial of a statement is that from where you sit? Do you think are enterprise customers due for disappointment when they get the check, or when they get the bill for generative AI, or do you think, you know, the vendor community is capable of delivering on the promise?
But I think it's definitely like something that we keep in mind every single day, is that AI is so interesting and people want to talk about it, but then it can lead to the Gartner hype. And so, but I think to me, the most important thing is actually not how high the hype curve or how low the trough is, as you naturally with every technology have to go through this, right? The nature of the curve is that it's always going to happen. But at the end of it, when it's all done, like how much value did you have at the end? And so for us, we actually talk about it. We're like, concentrate on the long-term value. And we use like an internal, we talk about internally, take the word AI out of it. And is it still a useful feature? And if it is, cool, let's build that one. Let's build the one that has a long-term value.
On this podcast, we talk a lot about the future of work in the context of what it means to practice AI responsibly.
Yeah.
And in the seat that you sit in, I imagine you're constantly thinking about the art of the possible, but perhaps constrained by not just what we can do, but what we should do. What does responsible AI even mean to you?
So for me, the words is a big and very important word, responsible AI. But in terms of what it means for me and my job at Box as a sort of a major user of AI, one of the key things for us is to make sure we're the content cloud, right? So we have hundreds of thousands of customers. We have, you know, hundreds of billions of files. We have hundreds of petabytes of data, and we're trusted to keep some of the most valuable data from these organizations and keep it safe, keep it secure, make sure it's used properly. And that's like fundamental to everything that we do. And then the moment though that you add AI to it, you just get these really giant questions, like these like really difficult, like how is this going to work? I think a lot of people who are doing like not necessarily like enterprise focused apps, they sometimes miss this idea that like permissions are really critical and sometimes very hard. So for instance, let's say you have AI and it has access to all of your employee data. It has access to all of your financial data, including an upcoming earnings report. Let's say you have it like access to maybe an upcoming M&A deal you're doing. Like, what's going to happen when somebody starts asking the questions of the AI? Like, and we've seen people who go build their own thing or like maybe companies that are smaller in scope, and they like sometimes just forget this really critical point that like every single person in your enterprise has access to different things, and AI needs to respond to that. And it can be hard. Like, you can't just train a model and expect it to figure that out. And so for us, we want to, when we're thinking about practicing AI responsibility, the first thing is to make sure that it is like safe and secure and it respects permissions. And we use this term enterprise grade, and that's a huge part of it. Like, enterprises, in many cases, the customers we talk to are very excited about AI, and they're also very scared of AI because of these kinds of challenges. It's so new that then the technologies are so, like, even the companies are very different. And so you have to make sure that you're focused on, like, you do not want your AI to become the biggest source of data leakage that you've ever experienced. And if you're not careful, that can happen. Now, on the responsibility side, like, as people are using it, like, one of the challenges that as people are dealing with business critical processes and they're thinking through, you know, the content that they have, workflows inside a Box and others, we often give them recommendations about what to do or what not to do. Even though we go out of our way to really make sure that the AI is not hallucinating, it's giving you very accurate answers, one of the challenges is it will be wrong. Like, everybody, like, no one should ever guarantee you that the AI is always right. Similarly, like, no person is always right. And so some people, when they're thinking about like these kind of like decision-making processes, like we recommend don't use the AI to actually make the final decision on things. And to us, this is actually a big part of our responsibility, is to help train people on how to use like our especially our content-driven workflows. And we tell people, let's say if something's important enough that like a classic example would be like the AI is probably capable of looking at a resume and you're able to like give it like a bunch of information about like what you want from a candidate. And it can probably tell you whether it thinks the person's a good fit. But you shouldn't do that. You should have maybe the AI pull out some key facts for you, and then you should have the person make the decision. And somewhere along there is the line about being responsible with the current state of the technology, while also getting the benefits from sort of the productivity and other sort of ways that you can work better using this new technology.
As technologists, we're so accustomed to only asking what could go right as we get excited about new technologies. And I think that this is the first time in decades when it's equally important that we ask what could go wrong. And as the leader of a technology organization, I just wonder, you know, how do you think about the personal responsibility that you have to create a culture where you may be perceived as putting the brake or putting your foot on the brake in terms of innovation, but because you want to enforce that as a culture, you also espouse the principles of doing the right thing, not just doing what, you know, what you could do.
No, I think this is one of the benefits of being at a company that takes very seriously what our customers trust in us, right? This we have some of the most important things in their company. So we take that very seriously. And to me, the concern that we have is a little bit less of, are we going to do something irresponsible? That's very much in the culture. It's one of our key things is to not do harm in any of these ways. It's just, you know, we're enterprise grade from that perspective. But then the other part of it is sometimes you get the new technologies are so innovative and so different that you sometimes you sometimes just try to keep doing things without necessarily thinking through like how this will end up. And to me, this is one of the things that like for AI, like it's just this common thing is that like normally when you're building stuff and you have new features or whatever, you have a hackathon, you're thinking of new ideas, it takes so long to get something that actually works and works well. And with AI, like generative AI, it's very fast. You almost collapse the first like 60% of a product development cycle into a day or two. And that I think throws people off sometimes because like then they believe that, oh, it's so close to being done, then let's just keep going and finish it. And instead of a lot of the work in making a really good AI-oriented product is around what happens next. What's the quality of it? What's going to happen in the corner cases if something goes wrong? Is it actually giving you what you want? And so even though the demo looks cool, keep trying it. Try to get it to fail and explore where the failure boundaries are. And that's because generative AI is somewhat probabilistic. It has that sort of that challenge that you have to manage.
So we're talking about generative AI kind of in the abstract. And you're talking to a very tech-forward, tech-savvy audience. But it may not be obvious. What are the primary generative AI use cases for a cloud storage platform? Talk us through, you know, where you feel like there's the strongest customer pull in terms of demand for generative AI related features.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of things that you can do, but one of the most requested from our customers and where we see like the most focus is today, like you just think about either your computer or wherever you store your data. It's so hard to find things. In many cases, this is some of your most valuable assets overall. But just extracting the information from it is quite hard. And it's because historically, like you had to basically sit down and read things. Somebody sends you something. I got to read. I got to understand it. I'm a human. It's unstructured data, right? So you have to like read the PowerPoint, go through it all. Now, the nature of the AI makes it so that it can actually extract these insights for you, in addition to being able to look at a lot of data and be able to quickly get you answers. And so we have a feature we call Hubs AI, or when we have a feature, where you can like, when you're reading a document, you can ask questions of it. So for instance, like, you're looking at this long, you know, maybe complicated document. You can just, it's as if somebody read it and you could just be like, what do you think about this? Summarize this, you know, pull out the key points. And so these are the features that our customers are looking at. And they're seeing like, this is very valuable for them to be able to basically make better use of this huge corpus of data that up until now required like individuals going through it one by one. And I think this is like for us, one of the keys is to make what people do and they do every day more useful with the AI to get these kind of general productivity benefits, but then also to unlock some of these new use cases from some of the more business critical documents.
Now, thankfully, there's a lot of enthusiasm around Capitol Hill for asking the question of vendors, you know, like I referred to earlier, what could go wrong? As the CTO of a company that may be the target of regulation, what's yours and maybe the leadership's team, the Box leadership team perspective on what's the right way to regulate Box AI, given, you know, even like the use case you just mentioned?
Yeah. So one of our benefits and also challenges is that we work across basically every industry, you know, financial, technology industry, government, and then of companies of different sizes. And we sometimes joke that because one of the challenges we have is to be certified so that they can use us. And so our joke is like, if there's a compliance certification in the world, then we want it because we want our customers to know that we're trusted by every measure that they can find. Now, this does put a big burden on us, but it also means that we are very comfortable with this idea of rules, of compliance audits, of being able to look under the hood. We have AI principles that we publish, and one of them is transparency of what do we do, how do we do it, what models we use, where they come from. And so that, because we know that if we don't do that, then our customers, in some cases, can't use us. They can't use the benefits of AI because they have their own challenges related to regulation, related to their users, their customers. And so we very much embrace this idea of we're not trying to do things that are hidden and proprietary and dangerous. We're here to do things that are open using the technology so that we can then share and of course, share with government bodies, share with our compliance auditors and share with our customers so they know exactly how everything works.
One of the components of the executive order put forth by the Biden administration in October is that any vendor who's selling an AI-based solution or capability would need to publish their safety protocols. Yep. And, you know, essentially, you know, prevent the vendors from, quote, grading their own homework. As a, you know, as a vendor, I know personally I have the concern about, you know, how much regulatory burden could be placed on us, given that, you know, we actually do place a high value on self-policing. Where do you come out on that kind of spectrum of, you know, can vendors be trusted to self-police, or do we really need a body like, you know, the federal government to enforce how we use AI?
I think so. There's a series of different things that we fully embrace. So number one is the self-policing. And again, we go through we publish our AI principles, we publish our guidelines, we publish our contract that spells out like what we believe we're responsible for. So this is a big part of everything that we want to do. And then again, to the point of, I believe that probably many of the compliance certifications, like FINRA, like FedRAMP, like these big certifications across industry, they have these names, different industries focus on different things. What we want to see is that they become aware of the complexity of AI so that you can have HIPAA compliant AI and FedRAMP compliant AI and so on. And so then we would then adapt what we think is our self-policing to the standards across the board. Again, we very much embrace this. And then also to the point of if there are like legislative rules that come out from governments, of course, we will always, you know, like fully respect those. In some cases, I think there's some nuances that the regulators will often, or the compliance certifications will be able to better handle. But overall, we fully embrace the idea that when you have a dangerous technology or a potentially dangerous technology and there needs to be rules, then of course, we will follow them and do our best, even if it takes a little while to develop those regulations, and even if it takes a little while for the sort of laws to come in effect.
We can't have this conversation without addressing the kind of dystopian vision that AI is out to take your job. I've talked in great volume on this podcast about the A in AI being augmented intelligence, and where AI is great at doing tasks, but not jobs. And I would think that's consistent with your view, given the use case that it's a, you know, potentially a productivity catalyst.
Yeah.
But what do you say to those who kind of the, you know, they've been labeled the term doomers, AI doomers,
yeah,
who really feel like, you know, the bot apocalypse is nigh upon us?
So in terms of the subset of doom, which involves the people's jobs, like I'm not a believer in the lump of labor fallacy. So to me, when things get easier and when things become more productive, typically people want more of this. And I think you used a lot of examples from history, and it's just a fundamental economics belief that I hold. So like for us, let's say, you know, when you start to look at engineers, right, and they create the products, they're the fundamental, one of the things that drives technology companies. Like we're very interested in getting a productivity benefit from sort of the power of AI as code generation. But the very last thing that we're thinking is, and so that we can have less engineering, we want more. We want to do more. We want to accomplish more as an engineering company to build more for our customers. And similarly, if you can use your content better to extract insights, to be able to find stuff, and everybody in your company becomes more productive, or you have a better internal process to deliver things to your customers, I don't think these turn into people losing their job as much as they turn into everybody having like better experiences and focusing on things that they maybe are better at focusing as humans, and again, automating some things that maybe took too long before. And so I feel like things are going to get better as opposed to, you know, there's a fixed amount of labor in the world and this will just take away some. I don't actually believe that will happen. Now, of course, we need to be cautious because sometimes when things change very quickly, people, individuals, in addition to like maybe parts of industries can change rapidly in a way that affects people. And I'm very respectful of that challenge. And that needs to be, I think, managed in many different ways. But overall, in the long term, I don't believe AI takes jobs. I believe AI leads to more better productivity overall.
So you and I are back having a version of this conversation in 2033, so in a decade. What is one behavior that is commonplace at work that today would seem like science fiction?
Well, it's a classic fun challenge of everything's moving so rapidly right now that it's maybe you can even ask in 3 years what would be different. It would be like equivalent of asking in 10. But so for me, I'm going to stay away from the AGI aspect of this particular answer and just talk through maybe in the enterprise or for you for the personal aspect of it. And what I see is as the technology evolves, as it gets more efficient, as it gets more capable, like personalized AI, like AI, I think it'll probably in the future, we'll probably end up with an AI that is like your AI that knows all about you. I mean, because it's funny of today, like the AI models, they're trained on the internet. They know everything. They knew all of the books. They passed all the tests and they're very capable, but they know very little about any individual person, right? It's not a lot, like it's a challenge of today is to get it to understand your data, like what you are and what you experience. And I think in the future, I think probably many companies are working on this now, but is you might end up with a really high quality foundation model, maybe GPT-4 class or better, that just knows everything about what you're doing and how you do it. And then that can be your ongoing like helper in many different ways. And I think as that, I think it'll, in some cases, it'll become more apparent over time, but like small steps in addition, maybe some big ones, like that can be a really interesting way by which in the future we have AI that helps us do a lot of very personal things. And then that is, you know, answer this email for me, like the way I would do this task the way I would, like in that kind of thing, I think is going to be really interesting to see evolve.
We'll make sure we have you back in a decade and we'll see how you did.
Next.
Hey, Ben, we're about out of time, but I'm not letting you off the hot seat without answering one last question for me. The guy that you work for is a legend. And certainly in Silicon Valley, I feel like everybody's got an Aaron Levy story.
Yeah.
But not everybody works with him on a daily basis. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Tell our audience one thing, your Aaron Levy story that might surprise us.
So I don't know if it's surprising or not, but I was very intrigued. I was acquired into Box and I joined and met with Aaron many times. And I think the way he presents himself publicly is also the way he is. So that's great. But then one of the first things that I experienced with Aaron was he did a magic show. And it was very interesting because he's actually weirdly a very good magician. And it was like, you look on his Twitter handle and he's like chief magician of Box and you're like, that's crazy is that, and he's good at this, but also to me, it's a little bit of the fun of Aaron and the fun of Box is that there's a value of bring your own self to work. You can do whatever you want. And I think Aaron exemplifies that in that he was constantly doing magic for people around the office. And that just makes it fun.
So you got to tell Aaron that we've had 250 guests plus on this podcast. We've had many CEOs and many CTOs. We've never had a magician. So Aaron's got an open invitation to come in. Maybe that'll be a video episode, but Aaron's got an open invitation to come in. Regale our audience with feats of magic.
I think he would really enjoy that. I'll let him know.
Excellent. Hey, Ben, this has been a lot of fun. Where can the audience learn more about you and the work of the technology organization at Box?
You absolutely can go to box.com, read about it. If you go to box.com/AI, you can see our AI capabilities. And of course, if you're interested, you just go in, you start a trial, you start to see what Box is all about and how it works. And we're happy to, you can contact me if you'd like, and I'm happy to tell you all about it.
Brilliant. Well, this has been a lot of fun, and we are all rooting for you and for Aaron, the magician, and for Box to succeed. And that's all the time we have for this week on AI and the Future of Work. I'm your host, Dan Turchin from PeopleRain. And of course, we're back next week with another fascinating guest.